Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute, where Senator Canavan makes a welcome return after a visit here some years ago. He's well known to all of you, so I'll be very brief in introducing the minister. He's the Minister for Resources in Northern Australia, and very well known, and of course played a very influential role in the recent election campaign, particularly in Queensland, but not only in Queensland. And tonight, the minister's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the link between Pope Pius XI and Australia's Bob Brown. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining me here this evening. And it is good to be back. It's a real privilege to be here at the Sydney Institute again. And I do want to start by talking a little about the recent election. As many of you will know, Bob Brown thought it a good idea to travel up to my part of the world, up to central Queensland, on a bit of a convoy to lecture everybody about how evil we were and what have you. And it's one thing I have in common with Bob, because I thought it was a good idea too. And while on the road, the convoy tweeted a picture, or posted, I can't remember if it was Twitter or whatever, but they posted a picture of the beautiful cliffs near Springshaw in central Queensland, for those who might have been there. And the comment under it was, they didn't realise how beautiful central Queensland was. And as a proud central Queenslander, it sort of summed up to me the folly of their endeavour, that they'd come all this way up to our part of the world and post something about, obviously, that's something they'd never seen before. They'd never been there before. And I don't know what their expectations were about what central Queensland looked like. They're obviously a bit surprised that there might have been something beautiful, because perhaps, given we're all, well, we've got a lot of coal mines, maybe they thought, I don't know, that we were some barren landscape where orc-like creatures would randomly emerge from sulphur-emitting mines or some such. You know, they just did not seem to think that there could be something of beauty next to and around coal mines which exist in central Queensland. Now, if you're going to denounce the practices of a whole region, and travel up, take the effort to travel up and do so, you think you might familiarise yourself with that region first, or with the people, before you do so. But not when we have this busybody approach to modern politics, where you take on a moral burden to fix the problem of others that you know little about and you have less to do with. And this whole approach threatens, in my view, our modern democracy. Because people are losing faith in democracy right across the Western world, and there are many reasons for this, but I think, at least in part, the erosion of simple respect for others and the different views that many will have in a nation and as diverse and large as us is one of the reasons. Now, almost 90 years ago, Pope Pius XI did coin the term subsidiarity. And in his 1931 encyclical, Quadrissimo Anno, I'm not very good with Italian pronunciation, sorry, surprisingly so, but the Pope wrote that just as it is gravely wrong to take from individuals what they can accomplish by their own initiative and industry and give it to the community, so also it is an injustice at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organisations can do. For every social activity ought to, of its very nature, to furnish help to the members of the body social and never destroy and absorb them. The modern interpretation of this concept has come to mean something like what was described in the 2014 discussion paper on federation reform as responsibility for particular areas should rest with the lowest form of social organisation capable of performing that function effectively. In my view, removing some of the poison affecting modern democracies requires us to rediscover these truths about the wisdom of the small over the power of the big. Now, I don't blame the Green activists for their ignorance about us up there in central Queensland. I know little of inner-city Melbourne myself, and I may think that hook turns are a particularly stupid way to manage urban traffic flows, and I think it's demonstrated by the evolutionary evidence that no other city, to my knowledge, has adopted this confusing practice. But I don't travel out of Melbourne and tell them, you know, condemn them and tell them that they should repent their ways. Melbourne can decide how to manage its traffic flows the way Melbourne wishes. Good fences make for good neighbours. We should respect the different views and desires that will manifest in different parts of our country. It is one of the paradoxes that is truthful. Tolerating disagreement builds greater solidarity. Agreeing to disagree on the smaller local things will make a stronger and more united nation on the bigger things. Before I get to that in more detail, I do want to go into a bit more about what happened at the election. As the Prime Minister said on election night, how good is Queensland? Queensland recorded the strongest vote to the Liberal National Government at 58.4% in two-party preferred terms and a swing to the LNP of 4.3%. If not for Queensland, the Liberal National Government would have lost the two-party preferred vote, albeit just. The result was just as stark, however, when you divide the country up into different regions that perhaps make more sense than just the lines on a map that create states and territories. The Australian Electoral Commission divide electorates up into four different categories for demographic purposes. They designate seats as either inner metropolitan, outer metropolitan, provincial, and rural. Like the Queensland example, there are stark differences across the country. The Labor Party actually won the metro seats, that's the inner and outer metropolitan seats, when you put them together, they won those with a vote of 52.6% of the two-party preferred vote, but they lost the regional areas, that's the rural and provincial put together, with only 43% of the two-party preferred vote. Now, the Labor Party for a long time has done better in metropolitan areas than in regional areas, but the gap is getting larger. For the federal elections between 2007 and 2016, the difference in Labor's vote between the city and bush was about 6 to 7 percentage points. At this last election, the gap jumped to 9 percentage points. But these results are even starker for the Labor Party when you just look at the rural areas, not the provincial areas, the really remote areas in Australia. In rural Australia, the Labor Party's primary vote has fallen from 35% in 2007 to just 24%, less than a quarter, in 2019. And because when you look at the two-party preferred vote, I should look at our side of politics too, because the two-party preferred vote's a two-horse race, obviously, necessarily the gap, or logically the gap between the LNP vote and the city and bush has been growing as well. In this respect, the gap between city and country is getting wider. I don't think this is something just affecting Australia. Trump's election in the US, the Brexit result, and rise of non-mainstream parties in Europe have all had, at least in part, a consequence of the uprising of regional voters, sending a message to the elite sections of the major cities. Now, I'm not going to have time this evening to go into all of the reasons why this divide is growing and why it is manifesting in unexpected election outcomes. It is certainly a combination of difficult economic circumstances, the centralisation of decision-making and political power, and the rise of national, global and social media. But look, just take Townsville as an example in our own country. Townsville's had a rough few years. At the bottom of the trough in the last few years, Townsville's number of people employed fell by 30,000 people. Now, that might not sound like a lot in a city as big as this, but if the same downturn had afflicted Sydney in proportionate terms, over 800,000 people would have lost their job in this city. Can you imagine what the political fallout would be if 800,000 people lost their job? But it can't all just be about the economy, because not every regional area has suffered the kind of downturn that Townsville has, and some haven't really had much impact at all. So that can't be the common reason for regional discontent across the country. What is probably more common, however, is that almost all small communities and towns at some point in recent years have experienced the frustration of having self-important bureaucrats run the ruler over what they can and can't do in their town. Whether it's what trees they can chop down, what seafood they can fish, what dams they can build, or what mines they can start. The power to do simple things has shifted from those on the ground with the knowledge, the history, and the interest to those who live far away, who know little of local circumstances, and suffer even less the effects of any mistakes they make. Call it the Bob Brown effect. It really, really, really frustrates people, and it leads to a lot of poor decisions to boot. Because just imagine that you had neighbours in your community who drove around your suburb critiquing the state of gardens and backyards of everyone in the neighbourhood. They probably wouldn't be getting too many dinner invites, but that's exactly what the Stop at Darnie convoy did in central Queensland. They drove around Australia, fueled by petrol nonetheless, telling everyone else that you're immoral and you must repent for your use and production of fossil fuels. They're the neighbours that comment on everybody else's lawn but without don't do their own weeds. The Adani saga that they were campaigning against has lasted for a decade. Adani first acquired the coal tenements from Link Energy in 2009, and they've just received the green light to go ahead. The whole thing is worthy of a satire, but it is not a laughing matter in central Queensland, where unemployment has been high and our economic future relies on investments like this. It went from tragedy to farce over the past year, while the Queensland government sought to come up with crazier and crazier ways to defer and delay the project. Nothing demonstrates this dissent better than the absurdity over the controversy over the black-throated finch. Now, something I really owe the Labor Party for, thanks to them for, because I know so much about this black-throated finch now, thanks to the Queensland Labor government. I never thought I'd know so much about one little bird. The finch is a small, canary-like bird. It is found in largely grassy woodlands. 100 years ago, the black-throated finch was abundant right across the northern part of our eastern coastline. It was prevalent from the Atherton Tablelands in the north right down to northern New South Wales. A report that was prepared over the last decade, as we've been looking at this finch, commented that by the 1940s, the finch had mostly disappeared from the southeast of their former range. Or to put it another way, the green activists, whose natural habitats are the hipster bars and coffee shops of southeast Queensland, benefit from living in an area that has completely destroyed the habitat of the black-throated finch. And they now hypocritically lecture others about the need for environmental protection of that same finch. Back when the inner-city Brisbane developments that the Greenies now call home, there were no environmental offset policies in place. There was no need to even consider the impact of any development on birds. Now, things are different today for good reason, and rightly so. Adani has spent more than $1 million researching the habitat and behaviour of the finch. It is probable that no one has spent more researching the finch than Adani. The development of the mine will disturb about 10,000 hectares of the finch's habitat. In comparison, the footprint of Brisbane, the geographical footprint of Brisbane, is 1.5 million hectares. To offset their impact, Adani has agreed to reserve more than 30,000 hectares for the finch. In that area, Adani will use what it has learned from the research to grow the proper seeds that the birds eat, design watering points that suit the finch, and grow trees close to those watering and food sources so that the birds can nest. In effect, Adani will build a hotel for the black-throated finch and do much more for its preservation than the Queensland government is doing. Apparently concerned about this bird. All of these plans had been worked through with federal and state government officials over many years. By end of last year, they were up to the seventh draft of their plans and what they were going to do. At that point, just before Christmas last year, the Queensland government, secretly and with no warning to ourselves or anyone, appointed a University of Melbourne academic, Professor Brendan Wintle, to provide a further review of what should be done. Now, it's not clear to me whether Professor Wintle ever visited the Carmichael mine site. Certainly, I had no reports of sightings of Melbourne academics in central Queensland, or at least not until the Stop Adani convoy arrived, after his report. Despite this lack of on-ground knowledge, Professor Wintle came to the conclusion in his report that the project was a risk to the finch, especially because it was going to destroy something called the 10-mile bore. Now, it's true that the reports commissioned by Adani showed that the 10-mile bore was a favourite watering point for the finch. But with a name like 10-mile, more questions perhaps should have been asked by Professor Wintle and others. Those who are familiar with the Carmichael mine site on the ground, have been there, know that the 10-mile is a man-made bore drilled by graziers probably over 100 years ago to provide water for thirsty cattle. It is not a natural part of the landscape. Yet the Queensland government, in at first accepting Professor Wintle's conclusion, was giving serious credence, I didn't think even they knew what they were doing, but they were giving serious credence to the view that a multi-billion dollar mining project, which could create thousands of jobs, should be held up to save one man-made watering point on a cattle property. You wouldn't build a footpath if you applied such strict conditions in urban areas. And when you start to get your head across this, you begin to realise why people on the ground locally are so frustrated when decisions are taken out of their hands and given to people who live miles away and have no idea. is this army, if this army of no idea bureaucrats and activists had gotten their way, things would have been much worse for the Finch to boot, because the Danny's going to put in those watering points. It'll be better for the Finch to have those areas protected, and the watering points will have a special design to keep cattle out. Now, all of this is just one example of the consequence of taking decisions in a way not consistent with the principles of subsidiarity. The further decisions are from their impact, the less common sense will be applied, and the more insulated the decision-makers become from the consequences of their actions and their mistakes. There are many examples, just like the Finch, some with even more serious consequences, like the shameful mismanagement of national parks which increased bushfire risks in rural areas. Too many decision-making processes today are a toxic cocktail of ignorance and indifference that leads to division and frustration. When this occurs, it's almost always because we're ignoring the principles of subsidiarity. When the armies of ancient Rome marched into battle, their ranks were made up in a precise formation. The first rank was made up of the young people, the hastate, I think. Again, my Latin and Italian is very poor. They were young men in the full bloom of manhood, apparently. The next line were princeps, and they were in the full vigour of life, a bit more experienced. But if these two first ranks failed, the third rank was a branch of proven veterans crouching behind, waiting to provide support to those first two lines. The third rank was known as subsidiary, or the subsidium, and from this word comes the term subsidiarity. It's important to note, then, that subsidiarity is not just about wanton decentralisation or devolution. It is not about leaving local communities to battle for themselves. But embedded in the concept is an element of support from the higher levels of government, or the veterans in the Roman legion metaphor. Still, the concept recognises the importance of letting local small communities fight first for themselves. As de Tocqueville wrote, decentralisation has not only an administrative value, but also a civic dimension, since it increases the opportunities for citizens to take an interest in public affairs, it makes them get accustomed to using freedom, and from the accumulation of these local active panniskety freedoms is born the most efficient counterweight against the claims of the central government, even if it were supported by an impersonal collective will. There are many reasons why we should allow local active panniskety freedoms to thrive. The first is hinted in the parable of the Finch above. Local people always have more knowledge about what can be done, and when decisions are moved to faraway areas, often people won't have sufficient understanding to make an informed choice. This also includes the era of just outsourcing detailed decisions to some kind of democratic vote across a large electorate. For example, in the Batman by-election last year, the issue of the Adani Carmichael mine became this massive political talking point in an inner-city electorate, far from the mine. The prominence of the issue affected Bill Shorten's position, such that he stated during the campaign he did not support Adani. And we may have prominently displayed that quote in central Queensland during the last election, so it was good for us. But during that by-election, a poll found that hardly any of the voters in Batman even knew where the Carmichael mine site was. The second point to make is that a central government can only do so many things at once. In Exodus, Moses' father-in-law advises him that he is trying to decide too many things, and that instead he should choose capable men to judge over thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens, and then let them handle the simple cases so that his burden would be eased and people would go home satisfied. In my experience, many of the delays in resource projects are often not because of activist resistance, like those in the high-profile cases that I've mentioned tonight. Often it's just simply because overworked planning or environment departments are trying to do too much and they can't meet the deadlines they set for themselves. The lesson from the Moses story is not just listen to your father-in-law, it's also that government should seek to avoid the mistakes of doing too much. The third is, in a country as large as ours, there'll always be different priorities in different parts of the country. The priorities of Armidale will not be the same as those of Artarmon, the priorities of Mossman will be different from those of Muswellbrook, and the priorities of Dubbo will be different from those here in Sydney of Drummoyne. That is not to say that different priorities are better or worse, or some parts of the country deserve to have their issues taken up more than others. It's just that no matter where they live, in a city or a suburb or bush, they might have different views. Yet we have political institutions that recognise and act on these. We must have political institutions that act on these differences. That's why I believe the National Party has an important role to play. Our guiding principle is that political representatives should not just be diverse in views, but also in geography. The priorities of small towns are always find it hard to have their voice heard, and they need strong representatives amplifying their issues. Where you live does shape who you are, and it's important that we have strong voices in our National Party from smaller towns and cities. That's what we try to do with the Nationals. The fourth is that allowing, the fourth reason this is important, is that allowing for different responses to these different challenges will counterintuitively unite the country as a whole. We do not have to agree on every policy to be all proud to be an Australian. Indeed, we would have a better Australia if we agreed to disagree more. Policies on coal mines, dams, tax policies, and even health and education settings are not the fundamental matters that bind a nation. Our general principles should be enshrined in our constitution and founding documents, principles of representative democracy, free speech, equality before the law, and a fair go. These are the broad concepts that we can unite around. At lower levels, we should welcome and respect differences. Yet, we have the absurd situation at the moment where the Victorian government has promised to amend its constitution to ban fracking. Presumably, the Victorian constitution in the future will read something like this: equality before the law, habeas corpus, and no fracking. Really stack up. There are broader failures of our parliaments to represent the geographic diversity of our nation. I've just returned from the first 3 weeks of sitting in the new parliament. In some respects, the Senate's very different from before the election. We now, the Liberal National Government now, it needs 4 votes to have things passed, from the crossbench that is, compared to before the election when we needed 8 votes. In other respects, however, the Senate has not changed at all. Before the election, more than 80% of senators were based in capital cities. After the election, more than 80% of senators are based in capital cities. In Victoria, South Australia and Western Australia, 11 of the 12 senators from each of these states are based in their respective capitals. Only around 2/3 of Australians live in capital cities, but in the Australian Senate, 80% of us do. The biggest capital city in Australia is effectively the Australian Senate. And this is a problem, because it does not give a fair voice to the smaller parts of Australia. It also violates the spirit of our constitution. Part of the role of the Senate at Federation was to provide representation to the sparsely populated areas of our country. The House of Representatives had concentration in areas, particularly at Federation in Sydney and Melbourne. This wasn't just enshrined in the specific provisions relating to the Senate. Sir Henry Parkes himself expressed something like the subsidiarity principle at the Constitutional Conventions. He said, "I think it is in the highest degree desirable that we should satisfy the mind of each of the colonies that we have no intention to cripple their powers, to invade their rights, to diminish their authority, except so far as absolutely necessary in the view of the great end to be accomplished, which in point of fact will not be material as diminishing the powers and privileges and rights of the existing colonies. It is therefore proposed, by this first condition of mine, to satisfy them that neither their territorial rights nor their powers of legislation for the well-being of their own country will be interfered with in any way that can impair the security of those rights and the efficiency of their legislative powers." Now, this gives me some succour, because even a politician as formidable and respectable as Sir Henry Parkes breaks promises. Australia has experienced a 6-fold increase in our population since Federation. Brisbane, Perth and Adelaide all have now more than 1 million people. They do receive adequate representation in the House of Reps. However, given the concentration of senators in these cities, the Senate is entrenching the concentration of power in the House of Representatives, not countering it as intended by our founding documents. I believe there are strong reasons for the Senate to exist, but part of that reason is to give a voice and influence to less populated parts of Australia. None of this is to denigrate the concern and care of my Senate colleagues. There are plenty of great examples of senators who live in a capital city but are doing great work to represent the interests of regional areas. Yet I know, having moved myself and my family to central Queensland to put an office in Rockhampton, that there's no substitute for living in a community and feeling, not just reading about its pulse. Talking to your baker, dropping your kids off at school, being involved in your child's local sporting team, all of these little acts put you much more in tune with what is of local concern. Some in my party, the Nationals, are attracted to using Section 7 of the Constitution to correct things in the Senate. That section explicitly allows Queensland to elect its senators on a regional basis and holds out the possibility potentially of other states doing the same. Barnaby Joyce has suggested that states be split into 6 regions and 2 senators are elected in each. In the past, I've done this at the last Sydney Institute speech, in the past I've suggested new states be created which would allow more senators to come from those areas. You can ask about that in question and answers. Dr. Michelle Evans from Murdoch University suggested other constitutional changes to help increase our adherence to the principle of subsidiarity. She's called for potentially the constitution to be changed to have a preference towards local power and control, or state-based control and powers. That the federal powers should be interpreted narrowly, and that the state should have a role in the appointment of High Court justices. My main aim today, however, is to identify the problem, not to specify precise solutions. Any serious actions, like those above, will take years to pursue successfully, especially any change to Senate voting constituencies or change to the Constitution. To make any progress along this path requires a greater spotlight to be aimed at the problem over a long period of time. I think, though, the recent election result has plainly indicated we have an issue and we should seek to respond immediately. I'll just suggest one minor change tonight that may help. Most parties in the Senate, people probably don't know, but most parties in the Senate, most senators, have things called patron-senate arrangements. So each of us in my party are given lower house seats to be the patron of, to look after. And my seats, because I'm based in Rockhampton, my seats are Dawson, Flynn and Capricornia. They are all in central Queensland. But those arrangements are held just within a party, and they become pretty political because of that. So they're focused often on helping those lower house members and candidates or winning seats. We could, in the Senate, adopt these more formally, where the elected senators are allocated across the state into agreed divisions. Under this model, senators would still be elected by their entire state, and they would not need to move to a different area, nor would they be restricted to only represent or work in a specific area of the state. But they could voluntarily choose a region that they would like to represent, with preference being given to those whose office or reside, or who actually live in that region. A process could also be established to ensure political diversity within a region. And if there were too many senators from a particular party or nominated for a particular region and too few for another, representation could be decided by lot. The Senate could establish a committee to which senators would be expected to produce a report on how they've represented their area and what the major concerns of their area are. Although this is a minor change and a bit bureaucratic, it would at least have a level of public accountability and measurability about the role of the Senate and what senators are actually doing. In suggesting this change, I'm not suggesting that the lack of subsidiarity in Australia is all due to the Senate or that even everything would be fixed by that change. There would be many other responses needed to ensure local communities or organisations achieve greater influence and power. This week, the push for an Indigenous voice in our Constitution has increased and gained a lot of focus. And I respect and understand the calls of Indigenous people for more influence and power over federal decision-making. Our Constitution already enshrines a kind of implicit regional voice through the equal representation provided to original states in the Senate. However, that regional voice is failing to be heard over the din of loud Australians. There are ways we can seek to amplify the regional voice within our democracy, and I think that is essential to help improve our decision-making and make sure that our politicians are more widely respected and restore confidence in our system of government. Rediscovering the wisdom of subsidiarity is a way of achieving these outcomes. Unfortunately, as others have stated, subsidiarity is often seen as the most well-known, most respected, carefully studied principle of government and almost entirely ignored in practice. Yet we should try, because as Australian academic Augusto Zimmerman has written, a good society flows up from its families, communities, councils to larger organisations. This way, the things that are most important to the people at the bottom are what guides decisions at the top. Or as Thomas Jefferson put it more eloquently, every state, again, is divided into counties, each to take care of what lies within its local bounds. Each county, again, into townships or wards to manage minuter details, and every ward into farms to be governed each by its individual proprietor. It is by this partition of cares, descending in gradation from general to particular, that the mass of human affairs may be best managed for the good and prosperity of all. Reconnecting with regional Australia would deliver a more vibrant, united and prosperous Australia. We cannot achieve a perfect union among all our communities, but we can learn to agree to disagree more. Doing so would live up to the true sentiments of Australia's Constitution and founding document. The very first words of our Constitution say, whereas the people of New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Queensland and Tasmania. Compare that to the Canadian Constitution, which begins, whereas the provinces, no mention of people. Or the US Constitution, indeed, which starts with we the people, there's no mention of states or their former colonies in the first sentence there. Unique among these constitutions, Australia mentions both the smallest social unit of the individual and a constituent part of that nation in the states in its first sentence. In this respect, at least, our Constitution is perhaps the most consistent with the principles of subsidiarity of any. It's time for us to reconnect with that approach and reunite in one indissoluble commonwealth. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. God bless. Oh, thanks. Thanks, Jared. Cheers.
So many thanks to the Minister for a lively and wide-ranging address. So we'll take questions and discussion broadly on the topic of the talk. Just going back to your title about Pius XI and Bob Brown, and and the point about subsidiarity. And I just wonder whether Dr. Brown may have had some kind of conversion experience in recent times.
He is concerned about local issues.
Because his opposition to bird-murdering wind farms in northern Tasmania seems to be particularly a localised issue. So do you think he may be heading the way towards Pius the 11th, or do you think it's just that he lives pretty close to the wind farms in question?
Look, come back. That's a good question, Jared. I have thought about that, and I have a more conspiratorial, perhaps, rationale, because I think what might have happened is during the election, Bob Brown campaigned strongly against the Sedani mine, and then the mine happened. And so maybe Bob's thinking, if I campaign strongly against a wind farm in Tasmania, the outcome might be just the same. He might have a bit of a reverse Midas touch. So maybe that's it. But look, I think I don't think he's had a conversion. I mean, I think the Greens overall, one thing I didn't really have time to mention in the speech, and it's not really my focus, but we can't forget that there is a push within some elements of the Greens political movement for a form of global government type of thing. Indeed, Bob Brown gave a speech a few years ago at the National Press Club where he extolled the virtues of effectively removing our sovereignty from Australia and investing it in some global sort of organisation. So that is their philosophy. Their philosophy very much, power should be taken further away from local communities and even exists today. And that's you've seen that experience in Europe and other institutions like the United Nations that affect us in some way. I don't think it's the right approach. It's not the right approach to build solidarity within a community. It's much better we invest more in local decision-making. Not everything will be able to go back to that local level, but we should be always wary of efforts to take away power from individuals, families, communities, invest in an amorphous, unaccountable bodies far removed from the impacts of their decisions.
Question
You said where people live is what they are. Pardon me, I'm in Wentworth, so we came back to the right side. But I was just wondering, in view of his great contribution to the coalition victory on the 18th of May this year, has the LNP in Queensland given any serious consideration to making Bob Brown an honorary life member of the party?
Yes, look, Leon, was it? Leon? Yes. Leon, a few of us have joked this. We started this group last week called the Parliamentary Friends of Coal Exports, and great to see some of my Labor colleagues join that. We need to re-establish some bipartisan support for that great industry. But a few of us then got together and thought we should start a little group, a ginger group, that is campaigning for Bob Brown to be given an AO. I was getting a little bit of momentum behind that while we were waiting for divisions in the Senate last week. But nothing formal has been set up, but I will be sending Bob a Christmas card, that's for sure.
Question here? Yeah.
Senator Canavan, regarding your analogy with the Roman legions, the front row is a damned hard place to be.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically of those farmers who have starving stock and are feeding mallee or mould to them and getting a lot of trouble with that, and also other examples of that. Is the government, particularly water rights and water, is the government willing to get behind these people? Because it doesn't often seem that they are.
So, look, our difficulty at a federal government level, and it goes, well, there's a tension here in some of what I'm saying. I suppose I'll start at the general level. I do want to see better local decision-making. I do want to see better outcomes on the ground, and along with what you have said, and I'll come back to tree clearing and water rights and those issues. But I am also a federal senator or a federal minister. And so if I am to be consistent with the principles that I'm outlining here, some issues are best left to, as I said, state or even local, further local government. So I don't support the federal government just coming in and saying, okay, all you states are doing stupid things and therefore this is how we should run things. Because that wouldn't be consistent with what I'm saying and would also set up a bad precedent, which we have seen in some spheres, where sometimes you get bad federal governments as well. And we're not always, trying to be humble in my role. We make mistakes from time to time. And when we make them at a national government level, we make them for the entire nation, not just for a small area. So I'm wary of of despite, you know, people do want the federal government to step in and restore land rights for farmers, or better, or more development of water, build dams and those things, but we can't do that unilaterally. We have to do it in cooperation, in my view, with the appropriate levels of government in charge of those things at state or local governments. The way to change these things is to change the governments at those levels. We have a democracy. We can do that. And I'll certainly be wishing for a change there in Queensland, given the state of the current government. But I will be giving full-throated support to those issues you've raised. I mentioned only briefly the issues around bushfire risk, but we had in my region some of the worst bushfires we've ever had last December. You know, the Queensland government puts this at the feet of climate change and other issues, and there may be a role here. But what I can't understand is, even if you do believe that this is because of climate change, wouldn't that make then sense to do more mitigation activities, you know, more clearing of fire breaks to in response to the higher risk that apparently Anastasia Palaszczuk says we face? But of course they're doing the exact opposite, making it harder for people to prepare for these kinds of events. And I certainly believe putting people's lives at risk. So we are campaigning very strongly for that, but that will require the Queensland government to see some sense, or a new government to come in with a different set of policies to do that. Now that does then go to that issue of, well, the problem we've got in some regional areas is we're only a small part of Queensland, and the issues we face aren't necessarily always front of centre of mind of a state government, regardless of their colour. So the same goes for dams too. We want to build dams at the federal government level. We've got significant funding for it, but Section 100 of the Constitution explicitly reserves the regulation of rivers to state governments. So we've got to do it in cooperation with them.
Go up here, and then we'll come over here. Yes.
I just want to go back to your saying the Senate is so heavily CBD, or Central Sydney, Central one. There are two Senate seats that have to be decided because of changes in the government. In Victoria, it's been suggested that Sarah Henderson should be given some consideration because she's out in regional Geelong. And in New South Wales, I understand the National Party have been saying we deserve the seat because of the
Section 44.
Yeah. How can the parties do something about this? Because seriously, that's where the fault is, the pre-selections there.
Yeah, that's a great question, Anne. I'm not going to comment on the specific pre-selections. I'll leave that to the respective divisions. A lot of this needs to be done organically. We have had a proud record in the Liberal National Party in moving towards people wanting a representation across the state. So I was pre-selected on the precise promise that I would be based in regional Queensland. At the time, I lived in Toowoomba, and I said to the pre-selectors that, well, I'll consult two people about where I'd be based, the party and my wife, and one of those two parties is more important than the other. But when I got elected, there was already a senator in Toowoomba, so I moved up to Rockhampton, and I think it's worked well, and that system works well. Likewise, we just pre-selected a new senator, Susan McDonald. She promised to go to Townsville, and so we still have that spread. So there's a strong demand for that in the LNP. I don't exactly know why that culture has developed in the LNP. I think it's been politically very successful because we are seen to be across the state, and maybe that example might encourage others. We've just had a Labor Party have responded and put a senator in Cairns now, before they were all in Brisbane or southeast Queensland. But I'm worried that just example alone is probably not going to generate those outcomes. I'm sorry to maybe deflate some, but obviously political parties tend to go into the interests of individuals within those political parties, so it's unlikely that someone who's close to getting Senate pre-selection but may, you know, live here in Sydney says, oh, look, I'll stand back for the good of New South Wales and let the person from Tamworth or Moree take it. That's unlikely to happen, because self-interest will win. So look, I think without more formal arrangements, and my proposal's quite minor, of course, but, you know, we do need to give consideration to those other opportunities. So I think it's a real problem. I think it's clearly a problem. We should not have 80% of our politicians in one chamber being so disproportionate against or not against, but apart from the interests in regional areas. How we fix that is a lot more complicated given its interface with the Constitution, party process. I mean, keep in mind, of course, the Constitution doesn't even mention parties. Another big problem with the Senate is it's meant to be a state's house. That hasn't happened because it's become a partisan house where we all sit and divide in political parties. A few of us often think, why don't we sit in the Senate in our states? The very least, right? It's another minor change, but human contact and behaviour does make a difference. So if we just sat as Queenslanders in one part of the Senate, that would at least, I'd probably talk to Larissa a little bit more and maybe we'd reach common ground on a few more things. But as Queenslanders, so look, there's a few things we can do. I do think we should do something.
Next question over here.
Minister, you touched briefly on the disparity, perhaps growing disparity, between the city and regional Australia and country Australia. Short of making it absolutely mandatory for everybody to watch ABC's Landline every week, have you got any ideas as to how we can try and educate, particularly the cities maybe, more as to how regional Australia lives and the problems they have?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get through a policy to mandate ABC watching within the Liberal National Party room, but it's a novel idea. It is still a very good program, but one probably not too many people in the city watch. Look, I think it's going to be difficult to convince people in any area to put aside their own interests and always or often consider the interests of others. My firm view about politics is all politics is local. The reason we did so well in Queensland at the election was because we focused on issues that were local and relevant to the people of Queensland, particularly around jobs and their future opportunities for their children. That's what grabbed their attention. Whenever you start going down a platform which is about the global and amorphous things, you don't grab people. There's no connection for them. So I think it'd be difficult in a political process to expect the people of Brisbane or Sydney or Melbourne to vote, to go to an elect ballot box and vote, based on what happened somewhere else. And I don't say that because I think people in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne are disinterested or worse. They've got their own concerns and issues, rightly so, and they want to see those reflected. They want to see housing affordability dealt with and public congestion issues dealt with. That's right and proper for them to elect representatives that deal with those issues. What we must do, though, is try to have a political process which gives due manifestation and recognition to the to those with a stake in those regional areas. Now, short of major changes, that's going to be difficult, but I'm concerned. It's often reflected in Queensland that there was a gerrymander largely under Joe Bjelke-Petersen, although that went back a long time before him, where rural and regional areas got a greater proportion of the seats in the Queensland Parliament. If it is a gerrymander, or was a gerrymander, it did certainly elevate. That worked, right? It elevated its self-interest. People wanted to get elected. Governments wanted to get elected. They had to have policies which supported the interests of those rural and regional areas. Now, I don't think necessarily it's a coincidence that over that time, Queensland was the only state in our country that developed serious and substantial large cities that are removed from connection to the large capital city. So you've got Newcastle and Wollongong here, but they are to some extent connected and close to Sydney, Geelong likewise in Melbourne. But Cairns and Townsville, cities of 200,000 plus, are the exceptions here in our country. And they developed over a period where this so-called gerrymander was in place. And the government, the then Joe government, got behind the Cairns International Airport and brought a tourism industry to Cairns. They developed the Townsville port and attracted the military there in the 1960s and revolutionised Townsville. We don't have the same incentives anymore in Queensland since that system was removed. And surprise, surprise, you now got 75% of population growth in Queensland being in southeast Queensland.
There's a question. Whoever's got the microphone's got the cord. Yes, question.
Hi, Senator, just listening to your talk, I didn't hear any mention of global warming. And obviously that was what Bob Brown and his convoy were going up there to central Queensland to highlight, I guess. We're looking at the moment in central Queensland, in Queensland in general, and pretty much all across Australia, one of the worst droughts in recorded history. As another speaker mentioned, or another questioner mentioned, this is meaning that cattle are having to graze on mulga and mallee and stuff like that.
Yep.
I'm just wondering, do you acknowledge that, I guess, global warming exists? And also, if...
Okay, got to be brief.
Opening up the Galilee Basin and the Adani Mine is against Australia's national interest.
Okay.
Well, I don't agree with the last proposition you put. One of the reasons I thought about this, and one of the reasons I didn't put global warming in the contributions, I don't. This is a broader issue than that, and I don't want it to get wrapped up in all the controversy over that, because the issues surrounding poor decision making in local areas go right across so many different areas that are not at all connected to global warming itself. So I didn't want to focus on that. But given you've raised that issue, this is another thing that frustrates people, right? If you believe, and look, I'll say up front, yes, I do think there's an issue with increasing greenhouse gases that contributes to some warming effect. I think the magnitude, size, and certainly the appropriate response to that is of due debate and discussion. But even if you agree or support the most concerning predictions of the IPCC or other models, no one can explain to me how a 10 million tonne per annum mine in central Queensland is going to make a jot of difference to that equation. Even at full development, so at full development, the Carmichael mine is 60 million tonnes per annum. That represents less than 0.25% of the world's thermal coal production. Yet, the Green political movement would have, and these activists would have you out there, you know, suggesting that somehow this one mine's going to blow the planet up. And that really frustrates people in central Queensland too, because we're not idiots, we're not mugs. We know, because we know the coal industry, we know that Australia accounts for less than 5% of world's coal production, that China accounts for half the world's thermal coal production. And I don't see Rob Brown, his likes, visiting the mines of Xinjiang, campaigning against them, because they don't want to go to jail in China. So they're not going to do that. So they've got this hypocritical situation where we would deny our own people jobs and opportunities in our country in a futile exercise, which would do nothing to help the stated objective to cool the planet, and other countries would still get that resource, they'll just go elsewhere. On top of that, the Green political movement has not dealt with this issue properly, that our resources are high quality, are generally low ash, are better for air pollution in Asia as well, which is another major environmental issue in our region, separate from carbon emissions, just general particulate matter. Our resources are much better for those environmental outcomes. If we deny access to our resources, it will almost certainly make for worse environmental outcomes in our region. Now, the Greens' response to that is, so that's a drug dealer's defence, because you're saying if I don't supply drugs, someone else will, or something like that. Isn't this the same party that wants to have pill testing at rock events? I mean, this is ridiculous. We have to make sensible decisions for the world here. We have an environment where billions of people in our region are coming out of poverty, massively increasing their energy demand, which is a great thing, like one of the most amazing things that happened in world history. We have, I think, an obligation almost, a moral obligation, to help those poor people improve their standard of living to something like what we have and just take for granted here. And hypocritically denying them access to those resources while we continue to use them, I think is not just, that does not just make any economic sense, it's also immoral.
Question here.
Owen Ether, Matt, thank you for your talk on subsidiarity. An announcement today, though, seems to run against that.
I didn't time that well, did I?
Okay, quickly.
The announcement is on the National Gas Reserve and removing unreasonable obstacles. Now, what would you say to an investor who's got capital, who looks at this and says, right, I can help Australia meet its problem with fuel security as well by reinvesting in refining capacity in northern Queensland? What do you say to him if you're going to have things decided at the lowest level as you're talking
about? Okay.
Well, and it's a great point, and as I joked there, I perhaps didn't time this all that well. I wasn't in control of the timing of the gas reforms. It's the discretion of the Prime Minister, but obviously tonight's the discretion of Jared Henderson. I'm certainly not going to disagree with him. Actually, I probably prefer to disagree with the Prime Minister than Jared. In very brief terms, yes, we've announced today that we would like to design a national gas reservation scheme. A couple of points, though, to make. One, I'm not seeking to override the state and territory's responsibilities here. I have a view that they should open up their areas to gas development. I'd like to encourage them in that endeavour and do so through this process. Number two, if we want to move to a gas reservation scheme here in Eastern Australia, we have a problem, and it's called the Constitution. In Western Australia, they already have a reservation scheme. And without distracting this event and going to all the details, it works pretty well. It's delivered low prices, lots of investment. It seems to be working. Now, they don't have a problem with the Constitution there because we're not really connected to the Western Australian gas market. So you can't really send gas from the west to the east. The West Australian government can't put any restriction on gas movements because the Constitution says states can't obstruct trade or commerce across jurisdictions. So to meet their aims, they can meet their aims because all the gas stays in Western Australia. So the 15% of gas they reserve stays in Western Australia, helps Western Australia. On Eastern Australia, we've got a different situation. If we're not involved and the states try and do reservation on their own, they'll have no way of keeping that gas in their state. So if Victoria decided we're going to develop our resources and have a gas reservation scheme, they actually don't have a way of any stopping someone sending that gas to Queensland and then potentially exporting it because they can't control what happens in Queensland and they can't restrict the gas flowing over that jurisdiction. So there's here, if we're going to have a practical response to this issue, we need to have the involvement of the federal government. The final thing I'd say is I'm pragmatic about these things. There's a debate here about investment incentives and what have you. I do think politically, to see the development of our natural resources in our country, indeed in almost every country in the world, we need to show the Australian people that there is an upside in terms of our own economic development, our own use of natural resources from the development of those things. So if we were to develop our gas in Victoria or the Northern Territory, I think Australian people want to see that some of that is helping our manufacturing industry, our industrial development, even though We're very happy to send a lot, and probably the lion's share, given the size of our country, the lion's share to other countries to help them too. So I think that partnership approach, that practical approach, has greater prospect of building political support for the development of gas, which we're clearly struggling to do right now in Eastern Australia.
And we're very close to the end. We've got a couple of minutes. There's one there. It's got to be brief. Okay.
Notwithstanding what you just said about natural gas in Queensland, what, if anything, can the federal government do to bring this about? And at the moment, we seem to have enormous reserves there, a big demand in Sydney, the constitutional issues and everything else. Is there anything the federal government can do to help this be resolved?
Well, there is this encouragement principle, right? And one thing I mentioned in the talk is subsidiary is not just about saying, look, it's all over to you, you're on your own. Good luck. It is about providing support, even from a higher level of government to a local level, to a local or smaller level of government. And I accept that it's a challenging environment for state governments to take the brave decisions necessary to approve gas projects. There's a lot of controversy around them. There's issues of landowner rights, the benefits that flow back to local communities. It's proven very difficult, not just here in Australia. America's a case in point in very different arrangements, but right through Europe, fracking is almost banned everywhere. Even in China, they're struggling to have it, their prospects developed, again, for political reasons. So that this is a real challenge. And so I think there's some role for the federal government to help support the state governments to make the best decisions for our country here, whether that's through something we're doing here around... We'll help do a reservation scheme so you can sell to your people. It's going to help jobs in Victoria or New South Wales, going to help protect manufacturing here if we develop Narrabri, etc. Or helping them develop the infrastructure and social and political communication necessary to build support. We've done that in Queensland with the CSIRO. We're doing that in Northern Territory with the Beetaloo Basin. again, using our environmental expertise and our resources at the federal government level to help them. So that's what I want to do in a cooperative fashion. I think your question was, how's that going to deliver benefits? Well, look, you never know until you drill. You never know until you drill. But, you know, the best geologists I have say there's possibly 200 years or more of gas onshore in Victoria. It's a shale resource like the US. Let's just give it a go.
Second last question here. Oh, hang on. Yeah, you've got to be quick, and then Philip.
Bill Bowman is my name.
Just be brief.
You mentioned the importance of local decision-making, but sometimes what happens over here has an impact over there.
Mm.
So thinking about Queensland, thinking about public perception, on the one hand, Queensland has tens of thousands of jobs and a lot of money coming in from tourism around the Great Barrier Reef. On the other hand, over there, there's the opening up to the Galilee Basin to coal mining. So going forward, can you still sell Queensland as beautiful one day, perfect the next?
Look, absolutely we can, because the development of that tourism industry, especially really in the past 30 or 40 years, it's taken off, coincided, in fact, came after the development of most of the coal mines in the Bowen Basin. And those mines are much closer to the Great Barrier Reef and those tourism sites than the proposed Adani Carmichael mine, which is 400 kilometres inland. I mean, the Federal Department of Environment, if you go on their website, is very clearly that there really isn't going to be an impact from the Carmichael mine to the Great Barrier Reef. It just can't be. It's too far. The water doesn't travel that amount of distance. It makes no sense. But even the coal mines that are closer, that are within hundreds of kilometres, 100 kilometres or so, they haven't had direct impacts on the reef. Now, there's another question around global warming. I've sort of dealt with that I don't think these mines here are going to have a manifest difference. The other point is that half the tourists to the Great Barrier Reef come from local areas. And so the more we can grow and develop and have more people in North Queensland, we'll have a stronger tourism industry too, because guess what? I don't mind taking my kids up the road to the Great Barrier Reef because it's easy, it's quick. I've got five kids, so getting in there on a plane is a bit expensive, but chucking them in the car and driving up the Whitsundays is easy. And one of the big issue we have in the reef right now is the misinformation that's being promulgated about the state of the Great Barrier Reef, and that is causing a drop-off in visitations, particularly from Europe. That misinformation is being spread for political purposes with no regard to the impact that those campaigns have on local businesses and people in Cairns. And there is I could have used that example. There's a growing frustration in Cairns about the wanton indifference that the extreme parts of the Green political movement have to the local business opportunities that exist there on the reef. And they purport to say they want to support these jobs and support these industries, and then they go off and run these campaigns without any involvement from those same businesses, without any consideration of the impact on them, and it's having a dire effect.
And a quick last comment? Yeah. Philip.
Your observations about trying to persuade state government, state and local governments to support development of gas are interesting. I mean, do you have a reaction to the fact that one reason why the US has developed their gas resources so effectively is that it supports your theory. Those closest to the resource,
yes,
you know, like the owners of the land, yeah, have stake in the development of the resources, whereas that's not structural in case of Australia. Yeah. I think that's a major difficulty in shifting those.
Well, I got another half an hour to talk on this, do I? Because I could.
We'll come back to where you started.
Yes, it's a good question to finish up. But look, I think you're absolutely right. And I've encouraged the gas industry to do more, both to provide financial remuneration to landowners in a way similar to what we see in the US. And the state governments have to be involved here too, because they take their cut through royalties. But also, even perhaps more important, provide those sovereign rights to those people. That's often what gets people's goat more than anything else, not just the money. If you live out in a rural area, you tend to have gone out. There's a bit of self-selection. You're out there because you like your independence, you like your fence. You don't like people just coming on willy-nilly whenever they want. And our laws, often at state levels, just allow that to happen. As I said in my first speech, you know, I've got more rights to keep my mother-in-law off my property than the gas company. She was in the audience that night, so it worked out quite well. And look, finally, I'll just finish it up. I mean, there's a broader issue here than just the issues around control and local decision making. It's also, you can sum it up, that communism doesn't work. And our system is the state owns the resource. and we're getting shortages and delays in development, just like communist countries do. In the US, private individuals own the resource, and business has a way of making things work.
Many thanks. We could have gone on for another half hour, but we won't. Look, thanks to the Minister for another lively talk at the Sydney Institute. I think it's fair to say that Senator Canavan was one of the youngest people appointed to a cabinet in Australia, and he's still going very strong at a very young age. So thanks for an important presentation tonight. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people talking about it, but we've said a lot tonight, and you've said a lot tonight, and we're very grateful. Thank you, and well done.
Thanks, Jared.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.